Yeah, it's a freedom. It's a funny thing. We like to feel we're all free. I don't even think I'm free. I don't even think I'm free to eat, anything I want for breakfast. So interesting. You know, there's things that, you know, you think, okay, well, the things are considered to be legit for breakfast. Mm. Cereal, toast, possibly a fried breakfast.
Mm.
If you want to push it out into the cooked arena. You don't generally have, unless you're waking up from serious, and you've got serious hangover, and you don't generally send out for an Indian.
But that's interesting. Interesting you say that.
I don't know. Maybe they do in some other countries. I mean, you know, maybe if you are if you come from an Indian culture, then maybe you do have curry for breakfast. I don't know what they do.
What's the old joke? Who has Chinese food for breakfast? The Chinese?
yeah.
No.
So there are social conventions about what you can, what you're supposed to eat, for breakfast.
It's just
it never occurs to me to eat anything.
It's just that you're not used to it. So I don't like. I don't like really kind of heavy flavours for breakfast. But in this house, we regularly eat curry for breakfast, like Japanese curry for breakfast, yeah.
Interesting.
I first went to Japan, I heard about this food and then eating it becomes... I get it. But you heard about this food. So when I was reading what they have for breakfast, oh my God, they eat, dried fish. Breakfast or fried, like salmon for breakfast. Yeah. I love salmon, fried salmon flakes on rice for breakfast is fantastic.
It's good,
it's very, very good.
So I wouldn't do it. And the thing, we were talking about this with somebody the other day, and it was kind of, there are certain things, that we do at Christmas that we don't do any other time, so it's kind of, it wouldn't occur to me to eat. For the most part, to eat turkey. Any other time than during Christmas, because it's just somehow it's just not right. But I should. But I'm free. I mean, if I think about it, I'm free to eat turkey. If I can get hold of it, I'm free to eat turkey whenever I like.
Mm-hmm.
But culturally, I'm really only really free to eat it without people looking at me oddly at Christmas. Yeah, having a tree. If somebody came into my home and they just saw like a tree, like this time of year, in March. April, and they just saw a tree in my lounge there, maybe with a picture of my daughter on it, maybe with some cat things on it, just there. People would look askance and go, "What the hell are you doing with a tree? What's that for?" It's very odd. But you put it in there at Christmas, and that's fine because you're supposed to have a tree. So there are certain things. This gets back to that kind of the Wittgensteinian thing that if there are a 1984 thing, there are certain things you just don't think about at certain times of year as being.
Well, that's like social things, but
so they go off the radar.
Well, how about more like biological, psychological, and political? So I was thinking, but when you're talking about children, I was thinking like because we were talking like as though we had like an object, like you bought an object. Oh, I've got a new TV. I've got the free will to take that TV back or do whatever I like with it. But with a child. How much free will did you have in? I sometimes think about this in the actually, producing that child. Number one, and keeping it. So, I remember once you said to me, I was talking to you about when Joshua was first coming along, and I said, "Oh, I'm afraid to drop him." And you said to me, "Instinct kicks in." And so that's so I often think about when they're looking at a screaming child, remembering looking at a screaming child, just thinking, why didn't Stone Age man just pick up that child and smash his head against the wall and kill it? It's so like 3 o'clock in the morning, a child screaming, it makes you so agitated, and I think it's meant to make you agitated as well. Mm.
Oh yeah, absolutely.
These are all, this is evolutionary biological determinism, isn't it?
Isn't it? Yeah. And and I always, I've said this before. I think I always have immense sympathy, or at least understanding for people who, I've got to be very careful how I phrase this, but people who. Crack under the pressure, particularly if they're single parents, and they've got the screaming child, and they've been out to work, and they're trying, and you know, they've not got much money, and they're living in a one bedroom, you know, apartment somewhere, and the kid won't go to sleep, and for somebody just to kind of lash out and just say, "Oh, for God's sake, just be quiet," and maybe slap the child or whatever. I'm not condoning, you know, child beating. But it sometimes makes me wonder that
how do we survive as a species? That's what I think.
I know. I mean, the wonder is that more people don't do that. You know, it's not an act of will, just an act of will. You're not just going to say, "Well, now I am not going to hit that child because I have decided," you know, as an act of freedom, an act of choice here, that I'm not going to, because it gets in under your radar. And people who for the most part, people who smack their kids or whatever when they're screaming and they're really, really young, they don't think to themselves, okay, you know, now I'm going to really teach them a lesson.
No.
I'm going to really show that kid who's who here. It's just this instinctive bang. You know, I'm going to just, you know, I can't cope anymore.
Yeah.
So there are certain things that I think, you know, get in under the radar, and this is Plato's kind of, in a sense, kind of when he's the most naive, when he just says, "Oh, well, you know, but you know, your reason can overcome anything. Your reason can overcome anything as long as you give it, you know, give it pride of place.
But
and then all your instincts, all the kind of shouting and screaming, all the rest of the, you would just be able to stand back from that.
But is it
be able to say no?
Is it reason?
You're charged about
things. Is it reason? Because
is what reason?
Like so? You, like you're saying there that, oh, I didn't smack the child because my reason, but isn't it not instinct that makes you stop smacking the child as well?
Yeah, it could very well. I mean, but again, it could just be instinct. As you know, it could be just environmental that, you know, you don't. You know, we have the instinct to preserve and to maintain the species. So that's why we give birth and we can constantly kind of, you know, produce children, and why our bodies are conditioned to enjoy the whole process of producing children. And maybe there is an instinct which stops us actually kind of destroying these children, no matter how hard work they are. There's something that kicks in. As you say, it's not always rational. I mean, you think about it, you know, having kids isn't a particularly, if you take away the long term repercussions for the species, just at an individual kind of existential level, it's not a very rational thing to do. You say, "I'm having this child, so what is this going to do?" Well, okay, I'm not going to get any sleep. It's going to cost me an arm and a leg. You know, I'm going to be tired all the time, so I'm not going to be able to do my job as effectively. The chances are that my wife and I are not going to have, you know, personal time for ourselves for a long time. And you know, in the future, who knows what's going to happen to these kids? They're probably going to be hanging around my neck for ages and hitting me up for money because, you know, the economy is so bad. And you think, well, if you present that in any other context, for any other decision, then that is a bad decision to make. I'm not doing that because that is a bad decision to make. But we still do it.
Yeah, colleagues and friends talk about having children. They talk about their children. Early on, I said, I remember saying, because everyone said, "Oh, you're not going to get any sleep. Oh, this, you know, that is going to cut." And I said to them, it's very easy to talk about the difficult and bad things, and it's very difficult to put into words what is the great things.
And to be honest, I mean, and it could be argued that maybe there aren't any great things. Certainly at the start of it all, you're just bringing up this little kind of monster that's just, you know, just constantly demanding in a way that you wouldn't put up with anybody else, you know, in your home. Maybe, as you suggested at one point, there is instinct that kicks in until such a time when you are getting something back, when you are getting a sense of a relationship building up and you can kind of communicate. Prior to that, maybe it is pure instinct that I'm just barreling through this. Because it's the right thing to do. Why is it the right thing? I don't know, but it seems to be the right thing to do, and I'll do this. And then you get to a point where you think, oh, yeah, I'm in a relationship with somebody now. It's not just them screaming at me. They've got a particular character, a personality, and now we're building up this kind of unique relationship.
Well, I have to say, for me, it was... I don't know if you ever felt this or heard this, like when you want to eat the baby, that's pure instinct, and obviously an animal thing. You see a little chubby leg, and I want to, but you don't.
No, of course.
You'll put your teeth in, or you know, their face, the little face, and then smiling, and
yeah,
and so yeah, you, it's very difficult to express that
Exactly. Yeah, you can't. I mean, it's tacit, isn't it? It's just kind of It just gets so much. You just get overwhelmed by this feeling to such an extent that you just want to absorb them into yourself. And it's like, I just want them to get. I can't get any closer than I just want to be. Yeah. I mean, it's a little bit like the first experiences of love when you're in a relationship with somebody for the first for the first 6 months. It's a bit like that. You can't be out of their presence. Yeah. You know, you want to be with them all the time. You want to talk to them all the time. You want to hear everything they have to say. It's all wonderful. I'm not saying it all goes wrong after 6 months, but it's a different. I think it's a different kind of experience after that when you're starting to kind of make. You're starting to get not contractual, but it's starting to become a bit more. Rational, where you're working out when you're going to be seeing each other, and you know what you're going to be doing with your finances, and you know whether we should or shouldn't get married, and it's less emotional, it's less freewheeling, perhaps. Not that it's any worse, it's just different. And sometimes people say, when you're in love, there's that kind of freedom. You're absolutely nothing else matters. Everything is just it's just you and the person. And I think in some ways, Plato. And that's why Plato was always suspicious of love and emotions like that. He says because that's precisely what he would consider to be being dominated by the animal side, by your animal passions, and you not being free. It's just like you're controlled by this overwhelming passion to be with this other person, to consume this other person.
Live in a world without that.
No, who wants to live in a world without love? Yeah, I agree. I would tend to agree with you. But I mean, anything. That, and you think, and you, as I said, you got this manifesting itself in kind of Augustinian theology coming out of Plato. This incredible suspicion that the physical will dominate you and take you away from the things that actually make you free. The freedom to worship, and it's always the freedom to do something rather than the freedom to move. So it's the freedom to worship God, the freedom to do the right thing, the freedom to obey the will of. So it's the freedom to obey, which is a kind of almost a paradox here. It's the freedom to commit yourself to a particular path, which will then dominate your behavior. So you've got freedom and dominance and freedom and determinism kind of bound together there. And freedom in the Christian tradition is a hugely slippery thing, because you get, for example, I mean it's used a lot in conversations about the origin of evil, because as the kind of debate, and the debate is still ongoing, but as the debate goes, people say, well, okay, if God is a good God and a benevolent God and wants the best for humanity, for his creation, then how on earth did evil get into the world? Surely God would, why did God allow all this pain and suffering to enter the world? Surely God would have stopped that. And, if God didn't stop that, then either God can't, which means that God isn't all-powerful, because it's something God can't do. He's not omnipotent. Mm. Or God doesn't want to, in which case God is actually not all good. He's not benevolent, because he's actually quite happy to watch us suffer. And there's a big, there's always been, and there still is, a huge discussion about this in terms of kind of the character of God. And what is often deployed as a way, as an attempted way around this, is something that's referred to as the free will defence. Mm. And the free will defence, in essence, is it's basically our fault. That God gave human beings freedom to do whatever they want. But that freedom was there, and they were being tested to make the right choices. So they could freely choose, if we go back to the kind of Adam and Eve story, they could freely choose to take the apple, or they could freely choose to not eat the fruit. It doesn't ever say it was an apple, but to eat the fruit or to not eat the fruit, to obey God or disobey God, to obey the serpent or disobey the serpent. You are free to do all of that. But once you've made that decision, then you're on that path. And those who follow the free will defense say that human beings used their freedom to take the wrong path. Mm. And having taken that one path, they are now eternally broken. So they can't, for the most part, right decisions, or it's very difficult for them to make right decisions because they're predisposed to the bad. And that's why you have the whole business about the need for salvation. Human beings can't save themselves. Human beings can't repair themselves in any meaningful sense. So the only way that human beings can be restored is if there's a new start. If a new human being makes the right decision Which is why you've got, and it gets all very complicated. Apart, why you've got this idea of you know, the Son of God becoming a human being and making the right decisions, and therefore you are now part of that religious kind of evolutionary line. You can now transfer from the Adamic line where you made the mistake and you're now damaged to that kind of. But there is still that idea that, you know, the reason that there are bad things happening, there's evil in the world, is because, you know, we used our free will badly.
Yeah, apart from. You know, sins of the father and, permanently damaged. I'm actually on board with the idea, the paradoxical idea of a God giving us free will. You know, and we can, and then evil can happen. That makes sense to me because it's like the ultimate gift, isn't it?
Yeah. I like that. And it is interesting, isn't it? Because, I mean, you wonder. Because, yeah, I agree with you. I mean, certainly abstractly, you could say, well, yeah, you want to be given. You know, if we are really to be considered, you know, seriously by the divine or whatever, then we must have the ability to make choices for ourselves. Mm. You can't be seen as being responsible, ethically responsible, for example, if you don't have free will. Yeah. Because, you know, if you know, you can't just say, oh well, you know, you did a bad thing. And you're going to be punished for it if, as you say, you didn't see it as a bad thing, or you weren't in command of all the information, or in some way you have a bad kind of spirit, a bad soul, which is prompting you to do bad things. And you can say, well, that's not my fault. It's back to the kind of, well, the devil made me do it.
Yeah.
It's not really my fault. And you've got a kind of a get out for that. And now we reconstrue that argument by saying, oh well, it's society's fault. I was brought up, you know, in a broken home, or I was brought up in a societal culture which encouraged it. I had no choice.
You hear now is like, you have unconscious. You're unconsciously bad, unconscious bias. Yes. You have that. I'm like, no, yeah. I'm not having that.
Yeah. No.
I don't know. No. I'll push against that. So it's like saying I've got so I'm bad. There's no choice. I've got no choice in the matter. So it's okay. To me,
it's just, you know, it's like in Who Framed Roger Rabbit. You remember that?
Yeah, I love that film.
Yeah, it's great. You get Jessica Rabbit saying, "I'm not bad. I'm just born that way."
Yeah,
and it's just, and again, you know, it harps, it kind of engages with all sorts of really current issues, a whole kind of free will determinism. And, you know, as you were saying, kind of the kind of evolutionary sort of instinctual stuff becomes really kind of frontline issue when you engage with you know, distasteful topics such as sexual abuse, particularly kind of rape and so on, because, you know, the standard defence for a lot of these things is, oh well, you know, I had no control over myself, I'm a guy, and I saw this woman, and, you know, she was wearing certain kinds of clothes, so, you know, the old battle cry of these people is, oh well, she was asking for it, you know, I couldn't help myself. You know, you see somebody like that doing that, you know, what else am I supposed to do? And that's, you know, and that's kind of that's awful. And this is one of the arenas where I think, you know, Plato does have something to say, that, you know, we do have control over ourselves. You know, just because I see, you know, I mean, why just that particular example of you know, being a sexual predator or sexually kind of voracious? Why is it, you know, oh well, you know, I walked through a shop and I saw something that I really, really liked, so I couldn't help but take it. Because, you know, and I know some people do have this shoplifting thing, but it's not kind of a defence that's normally accepted as a meaningful defence. Oh, I saw this exciting piece of technology, and I can't help it. You know, we're living in a technological age, and everybody needs high speed. I just had to have it, so I stole it. Or, you know, I was feeling a bit peckish at lunchtime, and I saw somebody sitting next to me had a really nice sandwich, and my hunger just took over, and I just stole it. I couldn't help myself. The idea of you couldn't help yourself.
Yeah. So, like a response.
Is that really a defence?
Yeah. That's why I think I don't like. I know it's embedded in sexism, but I really feel more and more like the idea of like being like chivalrous is something that we could get back, like, again, in a kind of, in a kind of limited extent. So I feel like, you know, mostly it's a big big conversation. Don't really want to get into it too much, but we're bigger and stronger than women as men. So we have a kind of obligation, in a sense, to look out for them, And obviously, most statistics tell us that most sexual crimes are committed by men. So we are, you know, in a sense, responsible as a kind of group. So the idea of like bringing back a bit of kind of chivalry.
Well, yes, yeah. I mean, and that I mean, that perhaps extends to all sorts of expands kind of broader to the idea of you know, those with any kind of power should support those who are deprived or weakened in those sorts of areas. I mean, I know, for example, I know some women who could lay me out very easily, without even breaking a sweat. And my old karate sensei, and you know, she was very accomplished, you know, kind of Olympic competition level instructor, and you know, I would be no threat. So you know, if we were walking down the street and somebody kind of came for us, you know, it would be nice to think, okay, well, here's somebody who, you know, I would be free in my sense of self worth and my sense of my own, if you like, when I call it masculinity, that I'd be perfectly happy for to say, yeah, you tell me what to do here, you take the lead here, and I'll back you up. But you know, you're the person who's got. I'm not saying I'd run away. You know, similarly, if you know, if somebody has a particular skill that allows them to have a particular power over technology, or over the economy or whatever, being prepared to say, yes, I'm prepared to accept that, not having that kind of pride, where you know, because that kind of pride makes you think, you know, I should be able to do everything. I should be able to. Well, no, I mean, just because men have had that image over the years of, you know, we all have to be absolutely self-sufficient and we're not emotional and the breadwinners and always be considered to know, you know, what's going on. You know, we need to be able to have the freedom to be able to say, you know what, I have no idea what I'm doing in this arena, and you know, you help me out. And in the same way, you know, as you say, you know, the other way around as well. So I think, I think that kind of universal chivalry should start, you know, start making a reappearance. And that was, you know, at its best, that was the idea of chivalry. You know, you have it in that kind of Arthurian. That Arthurian kind of mould, that these powerful knights would go out and they would protect the kind of the poor and the weak and the disenfranchised, if they were being terrorised by anybody. And we don't have that really, do we? I mean, we have, you know, the government. You don't really trust, you know, the government to do this. It's a lot of posturing, but you don't really trust them. There are certain charities you think, okay, well, you're out there, you know, working for particular people's best interests. But we don't have a societal convention where it says this is how we should roll. Yeah. We should all be kind of, you know, looking out for each other. And that's a great sadness. I mean, I sometimes, you know, I don't know. I just wonder. I think, wouldn't that be easier as well? Wouldn't that be just less effort for all concerned, to just adopt that kind of mentality, to know that, you know, you're not having to look over your back to kind of worry about what's happening. There's always somebody watching your back. You don't have to worry about whether you could do this or could do that, because there's always somebody around who could do what you couldn't and would support you in that. Just seems to be a lot easier.
Yeah, to me. I think
maybe it's just a bit idealistic. I don't know.
Yeah, I don't know. I'm not talking about limiting, and I know that there are outliers, and I've got my niece is a karate expert. As a generalization, you know, we're bigger and stronger and taller, I feel like there is a need there. To look out in that sense.
Absolutely. That's right. And I think, you know, we need to constantly consider, you know, what it is we are free to offer. There are freedoms that we can have, and we can say, yes, you know, because of my physicality, I have freedoms that these people don't have. So I need to be able to deploy that freedom. In a particular way and in an effective way, there are some people who are, you know, have other kinds of freedom. There are people who have financial freedom. Mm-hmm. So, well, yeah, maybe you guys should get together and start, you know, kind of making it rain and chucking out some cash.
Yeah,
I mean, that sort of age of chivalry just seems to be something that has been lost.
Yeah. There's a danger there, is it? Like economical, it's like the noblesse oblige.
Well, yes, yeah. What was that? Yeah.